Coming up today, Morgan explores the problems facing Google in Russia, and Grace tells us all about the Great Reinfection. You're listening to the Wired Podcast, your essential weekly guide to all the big stories in tech, science, business, and culture. I'm your host, Amit Katwala, and joining me this week are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Grace Brown.
Hello.
And Morgan Meeker.
Hey.
This was the week when the European Union agreed legislation that will force all smartphones sold in the bloc to use a universal USB-C charging port. The ruling could have a big impact on Apple, which is the only phone maker with a proprietary charging cable. The British government says it has no plans to bring similar rules into force in the UK.
It was also the week when the UK government purchased its first quantum computer. The Ministry of Defence said it acquired the technology so it could see how quantum technology can be used in various different security issues.
And Apple announced a new Buy Now, Pay Later service, which will be launched within its iOS 16 operating system, expected in the autumn. Instead of working with banking partners, Apple said it will oversee credit checks and make decisions on loans itself, a big leap into the world of financial services.
And finally, it was the week when a rectal cancer trial returned a shocking result. Every single participant went into remission. The scientists found no trace of cancer in the 14 patients 6 months after they'd been given a new experimental immunotherapy drug. It's said to be the first time this has happened in the history of cancer.
Morgan, this Apple thing is interesting. Is this just the way they're trying to use their trillions of dollars of cash reserves? Or why are they doing this move into financial services?
Yeah, I think it is really interesting. And it also follows a trend that Amazon have also been kind of like quietly creeping into financial services in different countries around the world, testing out different strategies. And Apple actually already has a credit card, but it has that in partnership with kind of banks. I think it's Goldman Sachs. So it's quite significant that they're like, we don't need a banking partner. We're going to do this on our own.
Do we have a sense of what rates and things like that they're going to charge? Because I know Klarna, which is probably one of the biggest buy now, pay later services in Europe, has come under a lot of fire for, like predatory advertising practices and plunging people further into debt. I don't really understand why Apple wants to get involved in this space, which is surely about to get regulated a bit more tightly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. But I've been speaking to buy now, pay later providers, and there is a sense that although it's a difficult economy, some of them have given me the impression that they expect inflation to be good for them. And they're kind of expecting, this sounds bad for ordinary people, but maybe this is going to be good for buy now, pay later. I mean, I've seen that Klarna is offering buy now, pay later for fuel and things like that. And so maybe it's going to be more widespread. Maybe this is kind of the replacement to credit cards.
To quote The Simpsons, it's a golden age for the repo industry. Lovely stuff. All right, let's move on to fun facts. Grace, what did you learn this week?
So this week I learned that greenwashing can actually be a crime. So greenwashing is basically just when a company makes misleading claims of being more environmentally friendly or sustainable than it actually is, when in reality it's likely just a marketing spin. But I actually didn't realize that it was technically illegal. So at the end of May, Deutsche Bank was raided by German police as part of a probe into allegations of greenwashing. It was supposedly because they had misled investors. But yeah, I didn't realize it was actually a crime. I thought it was just kind of like, you know, bad practice.
Is it like a criminal, like as in can you get sent to prison for greenwashing, or is it like more of a civil thing where you just get fined?
I imagine they probably will just get fined. Yeah,
that's a shame. I think there should be some sort of like appropriate punishment to suit the crime. Like if you lie about your green credentials, you should be forced to go and plant trees in the forest somewhere for 6 months.
The Deutsche Bank case is really interesting because it's basically based on one whistleblower, which kind of shows how important kind of one person within a massive company can be to be like, I don't think we're actually doing what we say we're doing. Mm.
It's quite interesting as well, because I think a lot of the kind of activity and the marketing activity you see around this stuff is essentially greenwashing in some way or another, right? There's a lot of companies that are doing some fairly dubious things and then hiding under marketing. So I suppose if you were throwing people in jail for greenwashing, you'd have to throw a lot of people in prison, which maybe would not be that effective. Morgan, what did you learn this week?
So I learned that chickens used to live in trees. So a new study by a trio of UK universities suggests that the birds first came into contact with humans in Thailand around the same time rice farming started. And it was actually the rice that tempted the chickens to start a new life living amongst us on the ground.
Do you think that they regret that decision at this point?
I'm going to say yeah. I read that apparently in the UK alone, 1 billion chickens are killed a year for food. So I think in retrospect, they should have stayed in the trees.
Yes, yeah. Terrible decision, chickens. Sorry.
I actually saw some another bird in a tree the other week, which I wasn't expecting to see in a tree. Was out in the countryside away from London, and there were some peacocks, and there was like four or five of them sitting in a tree, only a meter or so above the ground. But they were all just sort of like, I don't think they were nesting, but they were just resting, sleeping, or something. I was like, I've never thought about peacocks in trees before.
That is really interesting, actually, and I did not expect it to be interesting when you started off on I saw a bird in a tree. So congrats, Matt. That's fascinating. Let's move on to our first story this week, which is about the coronavirus. Remember that? Anecdotally, it does seem to be affecting a lot more people in recent weeks, and Grace has been looking into what has been dubbed the Great Reinfection. Grace, can you tell us what you mean by that exactly?
The Great Reinfection is something that I actually coined myself, which I'm very proud of. Basically, it's kind of just really a fundamental change in mindset about how we think about COVID. So I'm sure everybody remember in the early months of the pandemic, reinfections were basically non-existent. I think there was like one case in Hong Kong, and then later that was disproved. So really, it was kind of, we kind of were thinking this didn't happen. And then a couple more started to emerge from the woodworks. And so that thinking changed, and we began to think, okay, they do happen, but they're still extremely rare. And like every few months or so, there would be a new case of a reinfection. And every single time that case made global headlines, it would be, you know, like man in Florida gets reinfection. And so it was basically assumed that once you got it, you were pretty much done. You couldn't get it again. And if you did, it was extremely unlucky if you did. And so that's the logic behind why some people went to, you know, like COVID parties, if you remember those, to get purposely infected, you know, just like get their infection over with and get immunity. But now, you know, we're 2.5 years into the pandemic, and I think we can all agree that novelty is pretty much completely evaporated. And so I started thinking about this idea that reinfections might be the new normal, purely from anecdotal experience, to be honest. I was hearing, and I'm sure everybody was hearing, about lots of people who were getting infected for the second time or even the third time. You know, I had so many anecdotes from friends and family of, you know, oh, I had it in November and I just got it again, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was thinking, wow, this is just really, the mindset has completely changed since the beginning of the pandemic. And I was wondering, is this just par for the course now? Is this something we can expect for the remainder of the pandemic and maybe beyond that?
Were people really going to COVID parties? I didn't get any invites to any COVID parties, but maybe that's just because I'm not very popular. So as you say, Grace, there was this feeling that maybe if you'd already had COVID or if you'd been vaccinated, you were kind of safe for the foreseeable future. But that doesn't really actually seem to be the case. And you spoke to some experts to kind of confirm this anecdotal experience that you'd noticed. What did they tell you?
Yeah, so one point they all made is that basically hearing about more reinfections just makes, you know, basic sense. At the beginning of the pandemic, of course, there weren't a ton of reinfections because there wasn't a ton of people getting infected in the first place. So now, you know, we're 2.5 years in, way, way, way more people have been infected in the very first place. So of course, there's going to be more reinfections because, you know, you need to be infected in the first place to be reinfected. But beyond that, you know, basic math, there are more reinfections happening, and they're probably happening for a number of reasons. One person made the point that it's basically this kind of perfect storm. The immunity that people got from their first infection has probably waned by now. A lot of countries, including the UK, have pretty much abandoned all of their restrictions. And also, there is an extremely transmissible variant making the rounds, as we know it, Omicron. And it's really that last point that Omicron has now, you know, entered the equation that has really changed how often reinfections are happening. And the reason behind this is really just the virus has changed a lot, you know, in terms of its basic makeup. And one scientist I spoke to described it like this, you know, if your body had been infected with an earlier variant, you know, like alpha or beta or whatever, then Omicron is like that variety, but wearing like a wig and makeup. So, you know, when it comes up to your body and says hello, your body doesn't recognize it as COVID. And that makes it really, really hard to fight the infection because your immune defenses don't recognize it as something that it should be fighting off.
So they told you that reinfections are more common, that we've got this kind of new variant going around reinfecting people. But do you get a sense of how common they are, like how many reinfections are actually out there at the moment?
Yeah, so like I said, like we know reinfections are more common, but actually pinning down that exact number of how prevalent they are is actually pretty difficult. And this is thanks to a number of things. For one, there's been just a massive nosedive in testing and reporting after governments have pretty much scrapped all funding for those kind of schemes. And that's just made tracking all kinds of COVID infections much, much more difficult. But something else that is kind of muddying the numbers is that not everyone is defining a reinfection in the same way. So in the UK, health authorities, for example, require at least 90 days to elapse between a first and second infection for it to technically count as a reinfection. But then others like the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control use a shorter 60-day minimum between reinfections. So obviously, you know, if we're not all defining it in the same way, we're not all not counting it in the same way. But we do have some rough estimates, so if you keep those caveats in mind. So in England, close to 900,000 possible reinfections have been identified since the beginning of the pandemic. Of those, over 10,000 were actually a third infection. And almost 100 were a fourth infection, which is pretty crazy. And I also spoke to a scientist in South Africa, Juliette Pouliam, who has been tracking and studying reinfections in South Africa. And it's, what's interesting about South Africa is it's kind of uniquely placed to study reinfection. It can kind of serve as like a barometer for the rest of the world's reinfection future, given that Omicron, you know, was first identified there and has already made its way through pretty much all of the population. And the time that we spoke, around 15% of current infections in South Africa were actually reinfections, her team estimated. And she said that was almost definitely an undercount because South Africa's surveillance wasn't great when everybody was having their first infection in the first place. But to answer just how prevalent reinfections are, you know, in the grand scheme of things, she said they're still fairly rare.
I wonder what the record is for the person who's had it the most time. I guess there's kind of a maximum, because if you're using that 60-day window, then you have to be pretty unlucky to get it four times, especially with vaccines and stuff like that as well. Like, you'd have to be really, really unfortunate. So you mentioned Omicron further up, but how much is this to do with kind of new variants, right? So I guess we thought back in the day that we wouldn't get reinfected with the original strain of COVID, and I guess that was kind of right. So this is maybe more about Omicron than it is about some, you know, something else, that the people that are getting the same strain of COVID, our bodies are pretty good at fighting off the same thing again, but it's because it's changed enough that, that's why people are getting reinfected, right?
Yeah, so like, we can't say for sure why reinfections are happening much more often now, but it's likely that it's because of Omicron. And you're right, like, it's probably, if the same strain of COVID was going around, reinfections would likely be a lot less common. And there is actually data to support this as well. So the scientists that I mentioned previously, Juliette Pouliam, like I said, they've been monitoring reinfections for a long time, ever since the beta wave actually in South Africa, which peaked in about January 2021. So a long time ago. And they found that the protection and initial infection offered against, you know, getting reinfected stayed pretty much the same all throughout the beta wave, and then also stayed the same all throughout the delta wave that peaked the following July. And then they, as they continued to track, Omicron hit, and that really, really skewed the numbers. The risk of reinfection just steadily began to rise and rise and rise, and then it eventually just stabilized at this higher number. So your risk of reinfection is just higher with Omicron, they found. And other researchers in other countries have also tried to kind of figure out how Omicron is shaking things up. According to data from the UK, the risk of being reinfected with COVID was about 8 times higher after Omicron became the reigning variant in the country compared when Delta kind of held the crown. Another paper from Imperial College London, published in December 2021, found that Omicron was 5 times more likely to reinfect people than Delta. And studies have even shown, which I think is really interesting, that you can get reinfected with different forms of Omicron. So we know that like there's been a bunch of sublineages of Omicron going around. Another researcher from South Africa, Alex Segal, found that an infection with the original BA1 version of Omicron, if you remember that, offered pretty much little to no immune protection against the newer versions of Omicron that are currently going around, BA4 and BA5, which I think is really interesting.
That is really interesting, because you wouldn't necessarily expect that, like, if the Delta variant and the variants before that, if getting infected with those once offered you such good protection, you wonder why it's different for Omicron. I also wonder, and this is just kind of me idly wondering, whether the fact that we are just out in the world a lot more now is also contributing to this. And actually, maybe this shows that lockdowns were the right thing to do, and that perhaps if we'd been out and about as this much during those initial waves, then we would have got very infected with different variants of those initial types of COVID. This is kind of a manifestation of what a lot of people had been predicting from the start of the pandemic, based on what happens with other coronaviruses, you know, things like the common cold. You know, many infectious diseases, you know, you can get them, you know, there's lots of infectious diseases that you only get once and you're kind of protected, but there's many that you get loads of times throughout your life, things like the common cold. You know, most of us get it like, you know, once a year or more. And a lot of people predicted that that's where COVID would eventually end up. Does it look like that's where we're heading, Grace?
Yeah, I mean, people were very reticent to say that that's the way that COVID was headed for a long time. But I think looking at the data now, seeing that we're getting reinfected so often, it's kind of hard to ignore that that might be the reality. Obviously, keeping in mind that there are a lot of things that could stop that from happening, number one being a new variant that could emerge. But you know, if it is the case that Omicron remains the, you know, dominant variant that is going around, it could certainly be a sign that SARS-CoV-2 is beginning to kind of mimic the natural rhythms of other coronaviruses, which, like you said, infect and reinfect us many times in our lifetimes. We all come down with a coronavirus infection. It's estimated about every 3 years. Some people can get it multiple times, actually, within the same year itself. And it could be that SARS-CoV-2 is no different to that. However, one thing to keep in mind is that we don't quite know whether these repeat infections are due to the fact that the initial infection gives us immunity that wanes in the aftermath, or if the viruses themselves evolved to outsmart our immune defenses. And that's something that immunology itself has not been able to figure out when it comes to coronaviruses. Like, if it is that it just gives us really, really bad immunity that kind of, you know, doesn't last very long and then just kind of disappears, or the viruses are just very smart and they figure out, you know, the only way that we can infect this person is if we drastically change ourselves. And like I said previously, you know, put on this wig and makeup to make ourselves look almost unidentifiable. And so far it's kind of looked like it's the latter theory. It's the wig and makeup theory. You know, the viruses just outsmart our immune defenses.
There's been, a general trend in the last maybe 6 months to treat this virus much more like we would treat influenza or something that's kind of been endemic for a long time, and that we just kind of live with the virus, as some people put it. And that's probably one of the reasons why we're seeing much more reinfections as well. And I guess, you know, with the falling like case fatality rate and better treatments and stuff like that, you can kind of see the argument for that. Should we just like accept that we are, you know, going to get reinfected at some point with coronavirus and not worry too much about it? Or is this something that we should be concerned about in the same way that we're concerned about the pandemic when it first started?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a real consensus on this yet. But like, you know, like we said, we all get infected with coronaviruses every year, multiple times a year. And like, it's not something we stress about, you know. Even before the pandemic, you'd go into the office with a cold. Like, nobody thought anything more of it because it was not going to make you very sick. But if it could be, you know, like obviously a lot of people now do not get very sick with Omicron. It doesn't produce a very severe disease, especially if you've been vaccinated. But the kind of sense I got from the experts I spoke to is you should definitely not be seeking out a reinfection and should actively be trying to avoid getting reinfected. for a little bit of peace of mind, research has been showing that you're likely not to get a severe case on your next encounter with the virus. One study found that actually a reinfection resulted in a 90% lower chance of ending up in hospital or dying than your first infection. So that's pretty reassuring. But while your risk of, you know, severe disease or dying might be much less when reinfected, the data shows it doesn't mean that there aren't people who have died on their second reinfection. So, you know, this is not a gamble that you want to take. And also, you know, a big point and a massive unknown that's kind of pervaded the entire pandemic is that we don't know what reinfections are doing to our bodies. And it could be the case that a second reinfection could be the one that causes the long-term damage. You know, it could be the one that triggers long COVID for you. And whether reinfection is in fact leading to COVID is the really big question through all of this. You know, like if it is the case that we could get infected multiple times and that's just kind of par for the course and the normal part of the pandemic, that's fine. You know, people are not as sick on their second infection, but we still don't know what the long-term damage is. And we do know that when you get a COVID infection, it goes, the virus itself travels to all parts of your bodies, you know, like your kidneys, your lungs, all those essential organs. And it causes damage there. So we don't know what that long-term damage is going to do. And like I said, that's probably not a gamble that you want to take. And obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is that the more people that get infected or reinfected, the more likely it is that a variant could emerge. And, you know, we've gotten this semblance of peace, at least in the Western world, because Omicron is not a very severe variant. But it could be the case, you know, that a much more severe variant does emerge from the woodwork. And that is something that we really cannot afford right now.
That is true, although I guess that's also true of other endemic diseases like influenza, in the sense that like there's a reservoir of them in the population and they could just spring out. I guess the other thing that I've been thinking about while you've been talking, Grace, is like you might not know how many times you've been infected with COVID because as you said, they're kind of rolling back testing, and also because of asymptomatic spread. Like you could have easily had COVID and never even known about it. Just as a kind of little, I'm just curious, like, we're on Zoom right now. If you guys can hold up fingers to show how many times you think you've had COVID since the start of the pandemic, and I'll take an average. Okay, so the average is one. We've all had it once, we think. So I guess we're ripe for reinfection. So that's interesting. It's an interesting observation. I'm like curious to see how this plays out, and I guess morbidly fascinated by what's going to happen, I suppose. It's a fascinating story, Grace. Thank you so much for talking us through it. And it's really struck a chord with readers as well. It's one of our most popular stories of the year on wired.com. Do check it out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And let us know your thoughts as well, podcast@wired.co.uk.
For our second story this week, we are looking at the impact of Google in Russia. Since Russia's war in Ukraine started in February, we've seen the country block Facebook and Twitter in a kind of propaganda standoff. But one big tech company has gone under the radar somewhat. Morgan, this week you've been looking at what has been happening with Google in Russia.
That's right. So Google has become this strange outlier in Russia's Western tech crackdown. So while its US competitors are being blocked or forced out, Google's services are kind of mysteriously still available. So why that is exactly is a bit of a mystery, because relations between the company and the government are not exactly amicable. YouTube, which is owned by Google's parent company Alphabet, has been taking down vast quantities of pro-Kremlin content. So in May, the company said it removed more than 70,000 videos about the war in Ukraine, including videos that referred to the invasion as a liberation mission. So despite that, media regulator Roskomnadzor has not blocked YouTube, and the only Google service that has been blocked so far is actually Google News. Instead, the regulator seems to be taking more subtle measures against the company, lobbing this unrelenting stream of fines at Google's Russian subsidiary, something that actually started before the invasion. But in May, this basically escalated. Google said its bank accounts had been frozen by the authorities, which, according to the company, meant its Russian subsidiary was forced to file for bankruptcy. So without a Russian subsidiary, Google's going to find it really hard to make money in the country, but it has pledged to keep operating in Russia.
Okay, and just to back up maybe for a second, when I think of technology companies in Russia, I tend to instantly think of the country's homegrown tech firm. So Russia has got a very vibrant tech sector and has some big companies based there. So there's Vkontakte or VK, which is the equivalent of Facebook, and there's Yandex, which is the equivalent of Google, Spotify, and Uber all rolled into one. These domestic services are naturally very popular in Russia, which makes me really want to ask, how big is Google in Russia and how sort of entrenched and important is it there?
So the short answer is it's big. So to get an idea of how popular Google services are, for the article, I interviewed someone called Alina. So she lives in Moscow. She works in PR. She describes herself as a Russian liberal. And I got the sense from talking to her that she really equates US tech companies with freedom from Russian propaganda online and government surveillance. So that means she has gravitated to using Google basically as much as she can. So she told me she uses Google's search engine over local rival Yandex. She downloads apps to her Android phone from the Google Play Store. She stores her files using Google's cloud storage service. Since Microsoft Teams left Russia in March, she uses Google Meet for most of her work calls, and Gmail has been her main email account for 17 years. Then on her smoking break, she watches movie trailers or comedy clips on YouTube. So that's one of the most popular social networks in the country. So analysts have suggested to me before that the reason Google has survived in Russia this long is because YouTube is too popular for the government to block. Basically, the idea is that it would risk upsetting a large apolitical subsection of society who don't really care that much about politics. They're not that engaged in it. They just want to get on with their lives and watch YouTube. But Google has another trump card in its arsenal, and that's Android, the operating system that runs on Google phones, which are kind of the default in Russia. So according to Yandex, roughly 75% of Russian smartphone users have an Android phone sitting in their pockets.
And this is a really important point, and something that I think is easily forgotten in some Western countries where iPhone use is very high. Android is the world's dominant operating system, and in some countries has a huge market share, even above the 75% within Russia. So in Brazil and India, for instance, Android has a market share that's above 85%. So how much of an influence does Android give Google in Russia in these circumstances?
So I think there are two ways Android could give Google influence. So I interviewed analysts in the article that suggested Android makes it technically difficult to block Google services because they're all sort of enmeshed together on Google's cloud infrastructure. So Karin Kazarian, director and founder of the Moscow-based Internet Research Institute, told me there's a possibility that if the government blocked YouTube, that could have the consequence of blocking a more critical service such as the Google Play Store. So it could kind of have unintended knock-on effects. Now, that's just one possibility. Another is that the Google Play Store gives Google political influence. So last year, the Russian authorities went to great lengths to force Google to block an app linked to opposition activist Alexei Navalny. They basically turned up at a Google executive's home, threatening her personally with jail when she tried to go into hiding at a hotel. The same authorities kind of followed her there and kind of repeated their threats. So in that case, controversially, the company did block the app. But if its services like YouTube were blocked, I guess the authorities could be concerned that Google might be less inclined to cooperate or even less inclined.
Yeah, and there are a few different things that are going on here, really, beyond even the sort of like technical side of things of how you would potentially try to block some Google services and not impact other services, or the sort of like political side of what it would do for people's morale in Russia and sort of like internally their stance if YouTube was blocked. So Google does have deep roots inside Russia, and it's an important market for it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think when we're talking about this battle Google is engaged with the Russian authorities, we have to ask kind of why does Google even want to stay in Russia? I mean, the company's being hit with all these fines. It's a really politically sensitive area to be in right now. Wouldn't it just be easier to kind of give up on the whole market? So some people have suggested to me that the reason Google has stayed is sentimental. The company actually has quite deep Russian connections, which are easy to forget about. Its co-founder, Sergey Brin, lived in the Soviet Union until he was five, and he's spoken out before about how this experience
growing up in a political system that censored speech kind of shaped his views as well as Google's policy. And then on top of that, the company has always had a lot of engineers, so a lot of its workforce are from Russia. But there's a less sentimental reason as well. The company's Russian subsidiary makes billions of dollars. In an earnings call, Google said 1% of its global revenues came from Russia in 2021, up from 0.5% the year before. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but that actually means the country's percent of global revenue is doubling year on year. And Dan Ives, an analyst at Wedbush, told me that Google will have been expecting those revenues to grow. So Google did not reply to my questions about its Russian subsidiary's revenue or how it might generate revenue from its Russian users in the future without a subsidiary in the country. It simply pledged to keep operating, saying people in Russia rely on our services to access quality information.
So if it's going to keep operating but is facing pressure from the government in terms of fines and obviously has removed its local subsidiary and all of those things, like the relationship obviously isn't good here. What do we think could be next for Google in Russia?
So Google's now in this situation where it's operating, but it's not really functioning commercially. Alina, the PR professional in Moscow, said that she can now watch YouTube videos without any ads, and it's not possible to pay for her Google subscriptions anymore. So the company has been moving staff out of its Moscow offices, with a significant chunk ending up in Dubai. Ironically, by forcing the company out of Russia, the authorities will have even less leverage over the content that Google hosts. So as in the case of the Navalny app, there won't be any Google executives left in Russia to threaten with prison. So what does this mean for Google's Russian empire? I think it means that either its days in Russia are almost over. I mean, it could still be blocked, or it could kind of adopt this new model. It's based abroad and it could kind of antagonize Russia from a distance, similar to messaging app Telegram, which is based in Dubai and generally just ignores Russia's rules and requests.
Yeah, so we're now at a point where Russia's war in Ukraine has been going on for more than 100 days. We've seen huge amounts of stuff happening in sort of like the information sphere, with blocking of various types of content, various pieces of propaganda from the Russian state, as well as censorship. And like, this situation is obviously not going to resolve itself very quickly, particularly around sort of like the longer lasting impact of big tech in Russia and what that looks like, really. So what do you think really happens next here?
So I think Russia basically wants to encourage Russians kind of gently and less gently to use local alternatives to US tech platforms. So now Facebook and Instagram are blocked, more people are using local equivalent VK, investment is being funneled into Russia's YouTube equivalent RuTube, although it's still not very popular. But I think it will be interesting to see how much Google fights for its Russian audience. I mean, I suggested that Google could adopt a Telegram style model, but Google is not Telegram. It's this giant company that engages with lawmakers around the world. It is seen to follow the rules. And I think that if Google does adopt an antagonistic model in which is similar to Telegram, that would pose difficult questions in other countries. I mean, why is Google following the laws in Germany but not in Russia? I mean, do we want Google to become an arbiter on kind of what laws are good and which ones are bad? It's kind of a complicated position to be in.
It's an interesting dilemma for Google, in the sense that obviously their services are useful for the Russian people and things like that. And I guess they don't want to be, but they also don't want to be complicit in the sharing of propaganda. So, and I guess, I suppose Google is a route to free information that isn't blocked by the Russian government. So it, abandoning the country would, I guess, abandon the Russian people and leave them forced to use alternatives that are controlled by the Russian government. So you can argue that they should stay there for as long as they can from that perspective.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the more difficult thing is that if Google sees its mission as bringing kind of free information to the Russian people, I mean, that's not like an easy, especially if they're based in the country, that's not an easy thing to do. They're going to have to make compromises to stop themselves being blocked. So it's like, will you give a little on YouTube content in order so that people can still access YouTube and it's not blocked? Or are they just going to be like, okay, we don't care about engaging with the Russian authorities anymore. And if they can make their kind of infrastructure behind the scenes impossible to block or very difficult to block, as Telegram have done, that would give them a lot more freedom in terms of the political position that they take.
I guess the other argument is that if part of the purpose of like economic sanctions is to make life difficult for the ordinary person on the street in Russia so that they rise up against the government, then I can't imagine more of an annoying thing to happen than for the operating system that runs on your smartphone to get blocked, for YouTube to get blocked, for Google to get blocked. So there is arguably some power in that.
Yeah. I mean, it depends whether you consider information as something that should be sanctioned. And this is like a massive debate. I mean, yeah, okay, you don't want Russians to be able to like go to McDonald's and you want them to feel kind of the weight of the government's decisions in that sense. But then do you want to kind of cut them off from the information that the kind of truth about what's going on in Ukraine? I mean, is that going to help? I mean, I know that lots of people in the tech community don't think that will help and that information infrastructure should be seen as totally separate.
Yeah, and communications infrastructure as well. Like people, I'm sure, are using Gmail and Google tools to organize. I mean, part of the problem here is this ridiculous centralization of services under one company, right? And to this extent that you can't really separate information from communication from the operating system that runs on people's smartphones.
Yeah, and that was something that's so interesting doing this story and talking to Alina. I mean, it's kind of the EU's worst nightmare, what she's saying about how she just uses Google for everything. But then you transplant that kind of that problem, as the EU see it, into a different country, and it's almost like a defense. I protect myself from my government by using this one company for everything online. And I mean, that's a really interesting contrast.
And it's a very different way to the way that we might see Google from our perspective, as this sort of, you know, semi-evil hoover of all our information and things like that. It's a really, really fascinating story with lots of fascinating strands to it. So do check it out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. We have just got time for some feedback. There were quite a few bits of feedback in the podcast inbox this week, which we love to see. First off, special thanks from me to James, who went out straight out and bought my book after I talked about it on last week's episode. I hope you enjoy it. Someone else called James also got in touch regarding our chat last week about weird measurement units. He just sent us a Wikipedia link to a unit of measurement called a barn, which is something to do with nuclear physics that I didn't quite understand, but which did send me down a Wikipedia rabbit hole to the page titled List of Humorous Units of Measurements, which is well worth checking out. On that note, Jana wrote in from Finland about an informal unit of measurement there called a porunkusima. I think I've pronounced that correctly. That loosely translates to reindeer's piss and is apparently the distance a reindeer can travel without stopping to urinate, which is about 7.5 kilometres.
I don't actually think that 7.5 kilometres is that far. Like if a reindeer is travelling at maybe a reasonable speed, going 7.5k, which is about 5 miles-ish, like that's like every hour, maybe. So I feel like that's not very long distance to travel between needing to urinate.
What's a Matt Burgess Kusema, Matt? That's a lot further.
Probably a bit further. Like I was also basing this sort of like on my own sort of running speed and things like that. And if I was going for a run, I would travel more than 5 miles in an hour and wouldn't need to go to the loo in that time, all being well. And it would be like maybe 15 kilometers if we have to go into this.
Matt Burgess is coming from a place of deep knowledge here. What's the furthest you've run, Matt?
100 miles.
100 miles, everyone. That is a remarkable achievement from Matt Burgess and shows that he clearly knows what he's talking about when it comes to travelling long distances and urinating. There was one more piece of feedback on this topic from Andy, which I quite liked. He said, I thought I'd email in regarding Natasha's learning on measurements. Not an official one, but recently at a birthday party, my sister-in-law asked for her slice of cake as about a 3 minutes one. So she always refers to cake slices as if it were the time on a clock face. Not sure if she has ever asked for a quarter past, but an alternative measurement my whole family has now adopted. I really like that. I think I'm going to adopt it too.
I think 3 minutes is a very small piece of cake.
It's tiny.
10 minutes at least.
Exactly. I kind of agree. All right. Well, that's just about all we've got time for. I'm off for 25 minutes of cake. We will see you all next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.